Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2009, today's guest, State Department Foreign Service veteran Peter Van Buren, was sent to Iraq to lead a Provincial Reconstruction Team, or PRT. He had never served in the Middle East and knew nothing about rebuilding. He writes, quote, "People like me were what the department had been dealt to play this game. The new rules boxed me into serving or seeing my career flatline." He writes about his experience in his new book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Van Buren writes, "The rebuilding efforts were characterized from the beginning by pervasive waste and inefficiency, mistaken judgments, flawed policies, and structural weaknesses. $36 billion has been spent on rebuilding Iraq. The people sent to Iraq to spend this money were unqualified and untrained." According to Peter Van Buren, missing from the training was any history of the war and U.S. policies, any review of past or current reconstruction projects, and information on military organization, acronyms, and rank structure, any lessons learned from the previous year's work, or any idea of what the hell a PRT was and what our job was going to be. Peter Van Buren has served more than two decades as a Foreign Service officer with the State Department. His new book is We Meant Well, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
Well, it's nice to have you. Why don't we start off by talking about what you went through with the State Department to write this book? I understand that you're still there, but you were temporarily removed, is that right?
I haven't checked the email yet today. Something may have changed, but as far as I know, I'm still currently employed by the Department of State, though they are in the process of pushing me out the door. We have certain protections, civil service type protections, so they can't just kind of point the finger and say, "You're fired," and march you out that way, though I suspect that they'd like that. The State Department is an organization that's very much like the mafia in that you don't talk about the family outside the family. And what I did in my book, We Meant Well, was simply chronicle the events that took place over my year in Iraq, give a face to some of the things that had been written about by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction and some journalists, but put a real face on it and show on a very ground level, day-to-day basis, what the State Department wasn't doing in Iraq.
Why did you decide to write this book? Because I'm sure there are so many others like you who have had similar experiences. You're revealing a lot of information about this book that I haven't read anywhere before.
I was at a gathering just a few nights ago of people who had served in Iraq, and every one of them agreed they could have written a similar book from their experiences. The difference is that the State Department is a closed organization, and one has to make a decision that one is willing to sacrifice one's career to write about something like this. I went to Iraq very much as a loyalist. I had been working for the State Department for over two decades. I had my opinions about the war, everyone did, but we in the State Department are neutral. We serve at not at the pleasure of the president, but through administrations. I started out under Ronald Reagan's administration, served through Bill Clinton's time, and so forth. So I went to Iraq in kind of a neutral position. I was going to try to get through my year there, do the things I was asked to do, and come home. What I saw almost literally from the very beginning, the very first official action I was asked to take in Iraq was to sign off on a fraudulent receipt for $3,000 worth of goodies for a convention that had been held. From that moment forward, I was on a roller coaster ride of fraud, of corruption, of waste, such that it was at such a level that I started making notes for myself, started writing some things down, and eventually it evolved into enough material that I thought there was a book here. I came back to America and found that very few Americans were focused on what was going on in Iraq. This was the culmination of our war there, our 8 years of occupation. This was the showpiece, if you would, about after $63 billion, we were going to present to the world an Iraq that was stable, that was safe, that was a democracy, that was a partner of the United States. Those were the goals stated by two presidents. And it wasn't real. It wasn't what I saw. And so I decided to tell this story.
And we should note, you have never served in the Middle East before being sent to Iraq. You say you knew nothing about rebuilding. But you write that the State Department basically boxed you into serving or seeing your career flatline. Is that the way it looked within the whole department?
I think so, and I think most of the folks who were in Iraq were in similar situations. The State Department is not a very big organization. There are some 5,000 Foreign Service officers, people like myself who staff our embassies and consulates overseas. 5,000 is a relatively small number. There are more people than that on a single aircraft carrier. There's more people in military bands than in the whole Foreign Service. So the idea that most of us had never served in the Middle East, didn't speak Arabic, and had very little experience with any of these things was not particularly unusual. The State Department had a difficult time at first getting its people to go to Iraq. Many of us remember in 2007, as the surge was kicking up, a number of State Department diplomats, in fact, refused to go to Iraq. Some were political and were refusing to go for political reasons, but most of us, I think, were just confused, uncertain about what our role was, what our job was going to be, trying to understand how the training that we had received and the careers that we'd had to date, working in embassies and consulates abroad, somehow were going to translate into working in reconstruction in the middle of the Iraqi desert. That said, the State Department was very clever, and they created a number of carrots and sticks to make sure that people did sign up. It was almost impossible to get promoted without doing a turn in Iraq or Afghanistan, and there was enormous pressure. They cut back the amount of time that one was allowed to stay in Washington and basically pushed a lot of people, like myself, into these jobs. Like I said, I went kind of in a neutral position. I was hoping that the training I would receive before going out there was going to help me out. Unfortunately, the training was all of 3 weeks. The first week was a course we called amongst ourselves Islam for Dummies, some very basic things about how Islam works, not anything you couldn't figure out by reading a few books on your own. We then spent a week learning how to keep track of all the money we were going to spend, and since it turned out to be in the billions, that was kind of helpful. And then the final week we were taken to an undisclosed location in West Virginia, taught to fire a gun and drive cars really fast. I'm not quite sure about that part. I never fired a gun. I never carried a weapon in Iraq, and I certainly didn't do much driving. The whole episode was kind of bizarre from the beginning, and it reminded me in many ways of a bad first date. You're at the dinner table, and your date is picking her teeth and acting oddly and not showing very good manners. And 6 months later, you wake up and realize, oh my goodness, all the signs that this was a bad relationship were there on that first night. That's very much how I felt about my training.
You write that you only got 90 minutes of Arabic language training, and you write that missing from the training was any history of the war and our policy, any review of past or current reconstruction projects, information on military organization, rank structure, lessons learned from previous year's work, or any idea what the hell a PRT, a provincial reconstruction team, was and what our job was going to be.
That about sums it up. One of the things that I was very concerned about was knowing what to do when I got there. I got off the helicopter at my forward operating base. I was embedded with the military, and I was assigned to a very remote location. And I sort of said to the people there, so what are we working on? And they kind of looked at me and said, well, sir, we were hoping you would tell us. What happened in Iraq, and I obviously enjoy a little hyperbole and make fun of myself, and some of these jokes are at my own expense. But in fact, what we did in Iraq was fight 8 one-year wars instead of a single episode. Everyone there was either coming or going. I actually, the timing was off, and I actually saw 3 military units come and go over my time in Iraq. People were shuffled around. Everyone was either just arriving or just leaving. And so initially, one of the more difficult tasks I had was just trying to determine what my team had been working on, what projects we had paid for in this reconstruction effort, and what we had ongoing. Even that very basic information was very difficult to obtain.
Well, in reading your book, I often wondered who was making the ultimate decisions here? Who was your direct boss?
Well, we did lack adult supervision, and that was certainly one of the lessons learned as the United States continues to repeat these episodes of reconstruction in Afghanistan and probably coming up in Libya or Yemen, Somalia. You pick your favorite war, and I'm sure there'll be some reconstruction there. The State Department had inherited this program from a previous list of failures. In 2003, after the invasion, the Coalition Provisional Authority, Paul Bremer, sort of stood up a pretend government for Iraq, and he made a few efforts at reconstruction, never took it too seriously. And he turned it over to the Army Corps of Engineers, who played at it for a year or two, who couldn't get any traction on it, and gave it to the big army and figured, well, if more people spent more money, something good would come of it. Didn't. And the government then handed over large sums of money to some of our favorite international contractors, KBR, Dynacor, Bechtel, those folks, and let them try it. So by the time the State Department got involved, we were sort of the last folks in a long line. Our policies were unclear. It seemed that the best thing we could do was to spend money. My boss told me that we needed to spend money. We needed to construct things, do projects. When initially I wanted to cancel some things that seemed to be fraudulent, that seemed to be wasteful, his attitude was completely the opposite. He said, if you wait around too long, wait for these things to gel, your year's going to be up. Don't rock the boat. Don't go against the tide. Do what we're all doing, which is spending as much money as we can. It was almost as if by spending $100,000, we'd get twice as much democracy as if we only spent $50,000.
Did you have any interactions with former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and what was her role in all of this?
No, you know, Condi never returned my calls. She's out there promoting a book of her own right now, so
right.
I'm hoping that I could bump into her someplace. My level of operation at the State Department was a good three or four floors below where Condi lived and worked.
Her media blitz will begin in the next couple of days or weeks, I assume. What do you think reporters should ask her? I mean, so much information in your book could be handy for a lot of reporters who are going to be interviewing her about her book.
The questions are very, very simple, and that is, what did Reconstruction accomplish? And hold her to some specifics. I had a chance to meet with some people on the Senate Appropriations Committee who were curious about the book and asked some good questions. And they said, well, what should we ask people? And I said, ask them for the results. If the U.S. government spent $100,000 on a vegetable farm, how many vegetables were grown? If the U.S. government, as my group did, spent $2.58 million on a chicken processing plant, how many chickens were processed? What were the actual results of all this time and money and effort? I think that I would love to have the opportunity to take Condi or George W. or any of the folks that put us in this war. I'd love to take them out to the places where I lived and worked in Iraq and say, do you really understand what we got into here? The city of Baghdad produces 8,000 tons of garbage every day, and we're responsible for that. Clean water, medicine, health care, all these things are absent. How are we supposed to pick up that mantle? How are we supposed to supply those? And the fact that Iraq today lives at the bottom of all the statistics in terms of access to clean water, access to health care, employment, pick your favorite metric, suggests that the reconstruction failed. And I'd like to ask Condi what she thinks of that and why, if she thinks it didn't fail, what can she point to as a success?
Well, and what's interesting about your book, I'd say most interesting, is you hear this sort of $68 billion number. You hear about billions in reconstruction funds that were lost to corruption and waste. But it's hard to wrap your arms around this. And you highlight the specifics down to, you know, $88,000 spent on books that were translated into Arabic, The House of the Seven Gables of Mice and Men, Tom Sawyer. This was under George W. Bush. And then they were dumped in a ditch. And then you write about $5 million of Mobile Max solar water treatment units that were ordered and never used, a $171 million hospital opened by Laura Bush when she loved to talk about liberating women that never treated any patients. And the list just goes on and on and on and on. And I have to say, a lot of this was incredibly idiotic as I read it. I thought, who would spend $50,000 or $20,000 to print up children's calendars that were never used? I mean, who came up with these ideas?
That was me, Rose. The subtitle of the book is How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Iraqi Hearts and Minds. And I take credit, if you will, dubious credit, for some of these decisions. Let me explain how these things came about. We were under constant pressure from the embassy and from Washington to produce results, short-term results, results that photographed well, but something that they could say suggested the State Department was succeeding where all these other organizations had failed. In the case of the calendars, we did spend $18,000 to print up children's pictures on calendars. This came about because we were told suddenly that we needed to craft a project that was going to create some form of civic pride. Now, the neighborhoods that we worked in East Baghdad were horrific slums. These were places where there was raw sewage in the streets, where people lived in one- or two-room homes, where you're just as likely to die from a rabid dog bite as you are from a terrorist act. These were terrible, mean, nasty places. And so the idea of creating civic pride in that place was absurd to begin with. But we were told that we needed to do something by Friday, and thus the Children's Calendar Project sort of evolved. It occurred to someone that there were schools operating there. We had paid for them. The schools actually only operated half-time. Prior to our invasion, the Iraqis attended school, boys and girls, together. Following the 2003 invasion, as the role of Islam rose within their society, boys and girls were segregated, and there weren't enough schools for two of them, so actually kids only went to school half day. Regardless, that's what evolved out of our project. The fact that it was already June and the year half over by the time we got the calendars printed, the fact that few people had a place to put the calendar, and certainly very little interest in this type of thing when they didn't have health care, clean water, or waste disposal, didn't stop us, because our projects were not for them.
Mm-hmm.
They were for us. We made the calendars so that we could say we made the calendars. We made the calendars so the embassy could show them off. We made the calendars so that a journalist had something to photograph when she came out to see us. Whether the Iraqis got anything or not is irrelevant.
Well, that's the key point right there. I think you just nailed it in that statement, that this was not about the Iraqis. This was about making the U.S. government look good.
Absolutely. It was about making the State Department try to look good in particular. The State Department is a funny place. It is a place where we're always sort of worried about how we look and do people like us. It reminds me very much of high school, where who was popular was the most very most important thing. Keep in mind that the Department of State had been cut out of the early part of the war. Donald Rumsfeld, who was the head of Department of Defense at that time, used to refer to us sarcastically as the Department of Nice. And he didn't mean it in a nice way. And so when State finally got its chance to participate in the civilian surge that accompanied the more manly military surge of 2007, we were determined to be the most popular kid in school. And so these projects came off. They reached their height of absurdity, if you will, at the Potemkin chicken plant, as we like to call it. One of the things chronicled in my book was our spending of $2.58 million to build a chicken processing plant. This was going to take raw chickens at one end and turn them into chicken parts cut up in styrofoam and wrapped in plastic at the other end, the end of the factory, not the end of the chicken. And this seemed like such a wonderful idea that we went ahead and spent the money on it without considering at all where the chickens were going to come from. There was an economy in place that was supplying live chickens to the markets, and the farmers had no interest in busting that up. And more importantly, where all this processed chicken was going to go once it left the factory. There were no roads that could handle refrigerated trucks. There were no refrigerated trucks. And there were no safe ways to deliver the chicken to. So the chicken plant sat center and dark and idle. It smelled of paint, not of chicken. And we thought, well, fine, we wasted $2.5 million, and that was that. Until one day, General Odierno, who was commanding American forces in Iraq, decided that one of his young female blogger friends needed to come out and visit a project, and somehow the chicken plant got chosen. This created a real problem, because we couldn't decide how to best present this, given the fact that there was no chicken being processed. The sheikh who ran the local militia who controlled the chicken plant had an idea. He sent his sons out, and they bought up every chicken in about a 10-mile radius of the place. They stripped the markets. The price of chicken went up about 200% that day in that part of Iraq, as the word got out that the Americans were buying every chicken they could get their hands on. We filled the plant with chickens for the blogger's visit. She watched them be processed, defeathered, declawed, whatever was going on in there. It was great fun. Afterwards, she had lunch. We served chicken, of course. Not chicken from our plant, because it wasn't sterile, and we were afraid she might get sick. So we bought chicken someplace else and served it to her. Everyone was happy. We thought we got away with it then, until her success spawned more visitors. And we were forced to develop the Potemkin chicken scale to determine how many live chickens you would get to see process when you came out to visit. So, if you were a big-name journalist and wore tight T-shirts and had gray hair, let's say, just as an example, you would get 50 or 60 chickens. If you were a print reporter from a hometown newspaper, maybe 10 chickens. The point is that it was all fake. It was done for our sake, for the sake of the journalists who came out to see us. The Iraqis were mere spectators and probably thought we were crazy or corrupt or probably both.
Mm. And in meantime, the infrastructure is in shambles. The Iraqis have no access to clean water and very sparse electricity.
One Iraqi described it to me as, he says, "I feel like I'm standing naked in the middle of a room and the Americans come in and give me a fancy hat. And they don't seem to notice that I'm naked, but they put this hat on my head. And then later other Americans come and attach ribbons and bows and flowers. And everyone's making a wonderful fuss about the hat. Meanwhile, I'm standing there without any clothes on, and the Americans don't seem to notice."
We're speaking with Peter Van Buren about his new book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Peter was sent to Iraq in 2009 to head up a provincial reconstruction team. He'd never served in the Middle East and knew nothing about rebuilding. And he writes about the corruption and the waste and so many things that he saw in Iraq in his new book. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866.
You're listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We can't accept your phone calls at this time.
Issues that has fallen off the front pages. We hardly hear about Iraq these days, and we thought it was important to bring on Peter to find out what went on behind the scenes. So if you have any questions about what he experienced there, and as you're hearing him talk about the utter waste that happened in Iraq, what comes up for you? Who will be held? Will anyone be held accountable? Who should be held accountable for this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Peter, before we go to break, and I'd love to ask you about contractors after the break, mm-hmm. who made money off this? Because you've got a section about KBR, Kellogg, Brown, and Root, formerly sure. known as Halliburton, and you write that over 300 U.S. companies had people in Iraq, about 150,000 contractors of various types, almost uniformly white, male, and from the southern U.S.
The American contracting companies profited mightily from the adventure in Iraq. Everything that was done in what it called the backstage portion of the war, the food halls, the plumbing, the electricity, of course, for us on our bases, not for the Iraqis, was done by these massive mega contracting companies. They even provided security for us. Everyone knows about the Blackwater Company and their episodes in Iraq. But in fact, our military bases were guarded by Ugandans who were recruited out of Uganda by some other contractor to guard us. They made a lot of money, the contracting companies.
And they subcontracted and subcontracted and subcontracted.
And subcontracted and subcontracted. One of the great scams was that our translators were provided to us by an Alaskan native-owned company. The United States is kind of a contracting affirmative action, set up a situation where Alaskan-owned businesses had some advantages in the contracting process as a way of helping out the economy up there. So this Alaskan native met up with about 25 lawyers who created an Alaskan-owned company that had no Alaskans employed by it, had no offices in Alaska, and did no business in Alaska, but it had that name up front, and so they got the contract to supply all of our Iraqi translators to us.
And hold that thought, Peter. We're going to take a quick break. You can join us at 866-798-8255. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call, and we cannot accept calls at this time. KLW would like you to know that there is still time, however, to donate your vehicle to get a 2011 tax credit. Remember, we'll take your car, running or not, and turn the proceeds into great radio for you to enjoy in the new year. You can call 888-KLW-CAR. That's 888-525-9227 to find out how easy it is to arrange a free pickup before or after December 31st. Or just go online to klw.org for details. And thank you so very much for your support.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Today, we are speaking with Peter Van Buren. He is a State Department Foreign Service veteran. He's served more than two decades in places like Thailand, Japan, and now Iraq. He was sent to Iraq in 2009 to lead a provincial reconstruction team. He never served in the Middle East and knew nothing about rebuilding. He says that rebuilding efforts were characterized from the beginning by pervasive waste and inefficiency, mistaken judgments, flawed policies, and structural weaknesses. And if you have any questions for Peter about what he experienced in Iraq, what went on behind the scenes, and when you think about the waste and corruption that happened in Iraq, are you able to really dig down and really take a look at the details? And do you think anyone will ever be held responsible for this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866.
This is a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We cannot accept calls at this time.
yourcallradio.org. And Peter Van Buren writes about his experience in his new book, We Meant Well. And let's go to our first caller, Habu in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Habu. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, and good afternoon to you and your community there in the Bay Area. It's very good to listen to the nuances of your guest, and I have a comment and a couple of short questions. The comment is, while I hear your guest discussing the minutiae about calendars and chickens or whatever, when one looks at the broad picture, just standing astride and looking at the broad picture of Iraq, to imagine that after invasion in 2003 and until today, that there is the basic services, essential services like electricity, hours of electricity, water, sewer and other basic services, including hospitals, are even lower than when we entered Iraq, when the U.S. entered Iraq. And so that tells me the whole story. I mean, they may have many feel-good, touchy-feely stories around the country and these shoddily completed schools, etc., which may be good for the American person, listening to their 6 o'clock news, but it to the Iraqis and the people in the region, more importantly, this does not pass muster. So that is my broad comment. And also, just we meant well, and I haven't read your book, I have to confess, but I mean, this is also part of the, and I'm not accusing your guest, but this is the kind of feel good story which is meant to say we meant well. I mean, going and reducing a country to rubble, we really didn't mean well, and we knew from the very beginning that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And so I don't know how you can say we meant well.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Let me interrupt, Habu.
Yeah, I was actually wondering the same thing, Peter. When I heard you on Fresh Air, sure, and I heard the title of the book, it really was jarring to me, because I wondered if you said this in jest or if you actually meant it.
Yeah. The title of the book, We Meant Well, is in fact somewhat ironic. There's an element of truth in the sense that people at my level, at least, I think did have decent intentions. I don't think that I went there with the intent of lining my own pockets or profiting or anything like that. But in fact, the majority of the title, We Meant Well, is meant to be ironic. The things that Habu just explained, in fact, answer your question earlier about what to talk to Condi Rice about, which is, why are all of these statistics, why are all these services at levels below what they were under Saddam in 2003? So We Meant Well is a bit of irony. It's a sad way of commenting on the whole terrible thing that happened in Iraq. This was a country that was not at war with the United States. There were no weapons of mass destruction. This was not a threat to any of us. No one was going to come out there to San Francisco from Iraq and harm anyone. And we invaded this country. We destroyed its civil fabric. We unleashed the demons of internal strife, the Sunni Shia, the Arab Kurd issues. And then we walked away from it, or we are in the process, I should say, of walking away from it. we destroyed this country, and it's ending now when we're tired, when we've run out of money, when we're not interested anymore, when it's not on the radio, when it's not on the front pages. We're not leaving Iraq because we finished rebuilding it. We're not leaving Iraq because it's a better place now. We're simply leaving Iraq because we're done.
Peter, who do you think should be held responsible for this?
The people who made this decision are out there today still talking about how it was, quote, the right thing to do. Dick Cheney walks around a free man. George Bush walks around a free man. Condi Rice appears on The Daily Show and makes jokes with Jon Stewart about the weapons of mass destruction. I think they should be held responsible. 4,480 Americans died in Iraq. Over 100,000 Iraqis lost their lives since 2003. Two out of every three widows in Iraq was widowed since our invasion. Children don't have clean water. The schools that are there are falling apart. We wasted our time and money on feel-good projects and show-off things and bits and pieces of propaganda. This is a terrible, terrible squandering of American lives, American money, and American prestige in the Middle East at the expense of people who really did us no harm and meant us no harm, the Iraqis. And we continue these processes today in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Somalia, in Yemen. The list is a very long and a growing list. Every day we seem to add on a new country. The president has sent soldiers now, allegedly a small group, into Central Africa. Look, the joke here is not so much that we wasted money on calendars or my favorite project, the women's pastry baking classes. Well, those are funny things, and I certainly play them for laughs in the book, and we've joked about them here. But the tragedy was this. We went to Iraq with the intent of hopefully trying to rebuild that country. And instead of giving the people the services that they needed and the hope that they needed for the future, we gave them these silly projects. We squandered it.
And do you really think you were sent to Iraq to rebuild the country?
That's what I went there to do. I came over the course of my year to understand that primarily I was sent there to be there so that someone in Washington could point and say, look, we're doing the right thing. We've got our guys out there on the ground, and they've spent all this money, and they've done all these projects. Here, watch this video. I don't think anyone was really concerned about our success and our actual progress.
That is Peter Van Buren, State Department Foreign Service officer, who was sent to Iraq in 2009, even though he had never served in the Middle East and knew nothing about rebuilding. And now I would like to welcome Sinan Antoon to the show. Sinan is an Iraqi poet and novelist, co-founder of Jadalia, an independent e-zine produced by the Arab Studies Institute and assistant professor at New York University. Hi, Sinan. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, nice to have you. Before we get to your response to reconstruction, we've been talking a lot about the lack of water and electricity in Iraq, and you've got friends in Iraq, Sinan. What is daily life there like today?
Daily life is that electricity is still not to pre-war levels, so people get 5 hours of electricity only, and then they have to resort to generators if they can, which cost money and which have caused massive pollution. Traffic in Baghdad is really horrendous. Sometimes it takes some of my friends 2 or 3 hours to get from home to work. Baghdad has become the most polluted city in the world. Life is not even as good as it was under Saddam Hussein. And that really sums it all up. In addition to all of these other problems in other cities, which are caused by the destruction of the infrastructure and the use of depleted uranium, which sent cancer rates skyrocketing, and the use of white phosphorus in a place like Fallujah. And this is not all just from the destruction of this last war, 2003. What is elided in general is the destruction under the sanctions and the embargo and the destruction in 1991 when the United States took what short bombed Iraq back to the pre-industrial age. So speak of mismanagement and how resources are mismanaged. really lies the bigger problem, and one will not be able to realize the extent of the damage and the genocide, frankly, unless one knows what was available there already before.
What are your thoughts on, I would guess, a large portion of the public that have internalized this narrative that it's over? President Obama recently announced that troops would be withdrawing, and yet most in the media didn't ask about the embassy that's there, the largest in the world, larger than the Vatican. I don't know how many bases are still there. But what are your thoughts on that? This hardly ever even gets on the front page, let alone page 10 these days.
Well, it's the typical, I'm sorry to say, American amnesia when it comes to what the government does abroad. I mean, even think of Afghanistan. I remember 10 years ago listening to the news on NPR and, you know, allied forces are fighting the Taliban, blah, blah, blah. And now, 10 years after, and after thousands and thousands of Afghanis, it's the same news. But American public, by and large, has very short-term memory. And the discourse changes. But I have to say that my problem with even those who might have good intentions in critiquing the war is that the discourse is this corporate discourse about mismanagement. It's pointing out all of these cases where there was mismanagement. This is not about mismanagement. The entire premise of the war is not really questioned. I mean, when you speak of reconstruction, that means that something was already destroyed, right? We have to speak of the destruction then. And more importantly, no one was really asked by the U.S. to go and reconstruct Iraq. Moreover, Iraq had one of the largest bureaucracies in the entire Middle East. There were thousands of engineers that have degrees from even American universities who could have been used. And if Iraqis had the choice, they would not have necessarily chosen corrupt American corporations to rebuild their country. And even in the critiques of the so-called reconstruction, we have this parochial view which views everything as if it's a competition between the Pentagon and the State Department. And frankly, I mean, when one speaks of how horrible the situation was in 2003, I have to remind everyone, including your guest, that, you know, irrespective of Saddam Hussein, and I was never a fan of his at all, until 1991, Iraq had the best water treatment system in the Middle East. Actually, according to the Washington Post, it was as good as any in many Western European countries. It had national health care that was free. So in 1991, it was the United States that destroyed the infrastructure and started to destroy the social fabric of Iraqi society. So to say that we go there with the intent of helping them, to say that after all these years is insulting, not only to Iraqis, but to American citizens. This is not about intent. You work within a larger institution, a larger structure that is an occupying structure. And your guest didn't waste U.S. money. It's wasting Iraqi money. And simultaneously with this, you know, facade of reconstruction, there are a lot of other things happening elsewhere in the oil sector, where the United States guaranteed the lion's share for its oil corporations. So let's not forget that, and let's not forget that the portfolio of Dick Cheney tripled during his time as vice president. So KBR and the others. So the money was not wasted. Of course, it was wasted. It was stolen from taxpayers and from Iraqis, but it went to these huge corporations. And so it's inaccurate to say that we walked away. I mean, maybe you returned, I'm sorry, and wrote your book and now can joke around about what you did in Iraq. But the U.S. is still present in Iraq in a variety of ways.
Peter Van Buren, what's your response to Sinan Antoon's points?
I think most of his points are spot on. This is a terrible human tragedy, and it is very easy for Americans to just turn away and be distracted by some bright, shiny object. I'll give you a good example. When I was in Iraq, the area that I was working in was unfamiliar to me, and I was trying to read some books here or there, and I picked up a book called Black Hearts, which was a story about a terrible atrocity that was committed in Iraq. A group of American soldiers raped and murdered a young girl, a teenage girl, killed her family. And as I was reading through this book, I was horrified by the things I was learning. And about two-thirds of the way through, I realized that the incident occurred a couple of miles from where I was living in Iraq. The incident occurred in the area that we spent all of our time, where we drove around. Now, the idea that I could somehow be sent to this area, and no one in any of the briefings had mentioned this. When I asked the soldiers with me, none of them had knew this incident took place in this area, even though they knew of the incident. I realized we really knew nothing about what we were doing there. You could be damn certain that the Iraqis knew of the incident and that the Iraqis remembered it and that the soldiers before us who had committed this atrocity were remembered. But the idea that the United States could send us there without even telling us that this happened in our neighborhood really was atrocious. And I think Sinan's comments are spot on.
May I say something?
Yes.
You know, the United States knew what it was doing in terms of the generals, and the politicians knew what they were getting into. Let's not be mistaken about that. This was not about establishing democracy in Iraq, and this was not about weapons of mass destruction, because Wolfowitz and the others knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. More importantly, can we please retire this discourse of winning over the hearts and minds, because it's silly and it is offensive. It's as if people in the Middle East are little kids and you give them a cookie and they will love you, or they're little dogs. The way to win hearts and minds is not to go and publish calendars or even to go there. Hearts and minds are lost because of actual events on the ground, in material reality, not in discourse. In the Middle East, of course, there are people who are hopelessly pro-American because of their classes benefiting or because they are close to the regimes. But let's backtrack 10 years or 5 years. The United States supports Saudi Arabia, a vicious, hand-chopping, women-no-driving regime. The United States supports Israel blindly no matter what, when it bombs Lebanon, when it imposes an apartheid system on Palestinians. The United States supported a vicious dictator like Hosni Mubarak, who everyone in the Middle East knew was a dictator, and it took American media, mainstream media, 10 days of demonstrations to wonder, oh, well, is he a dictator? So to win the hearts and minds of Iraqis or Syrians or others, it's not going to be good enough to go there and give them a few publications or build them a factory. You have to realize that to change the entire policy of the United States, and that the United States, whether we like it or not, is an empire that supports vicious dictators and has military bases that bomb people with drones. It doesn't matter if the State Department sends saints to Iraq. So trying to win the hearts and minds is not good enough for me. You know, I'm sorry. Because the hearts and minds are already lost by the loss of lives, millions and millions of lives.
Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's go through a few, and then we'll get thoughts from Sinan Antoun, Iraqi poet and novelist, and Peter Van Buren, a State Department Foreign Service officer. Let's hear from Donald in Redwood City. Hi, Donald.
Oh, hi. I'd like to know from Peter if the policies of the United States in terms of reconstruction changed at all, concretely, specifically, if you could, give concrete, specific examples of how it changed for the better when a Democrat took over the White House and a Democrat heads the State Department.
All right, we'll get to that in just a minute. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Thank you for a good program. I must say that I was listening to it while I was driving, and I heard about the Potemkin chicken. I had a big laugh. But at the same time, I was very saddened, because what's happening in Iraq, where the scale is completely different, is a reflection of what's happening just about everywhere in the world where there is foreign assistance from the U.S. There is a great deal of mismanagement, waste, and disregard for what's happening locally. I'll give you the case of Haiti, where we are facing reconstruction. A lot of the work is being done by NGOs, many of them from the U.S. Many of them, the people working for these organizations are consultants. They're being paid $1,000 a day. They're given SUVs and stay in the hotels, a few hotel rooms that are still standing up. But the local grassroots people, the very, very well-trained Haitian professionals, are not really employed at all in these activities. It is very sad. And, of course, the great guru in Haiti of reconstruction and is a former President Clinton, who has contributed mightily to the destruction of Haitian agriculture. So what's happening in Iraq, I understand perfectly well, because it's being replicated in my own country. I'll stop here and take your comments off the air. Thank you for taking my call and for a good program.
Okay, thank you for calling in, Max. Let's hear from Lydia in Santa Cruz. Hi, Lydia. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I think the issue of international law could be considered even laughable, but I need to raise it because there is international law. I urge people to read books such as Philippe Sand's book called Lawless World about international law. It is required by international law that any country that attacks another one for whatever reason is required to help and effect the reconstruction of that country in an effective way. And I think that the State Department was simply covering itself by not really doing the job, pretending to do the job of reconstruction.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment. Why don't we first, Peter, why don't you respond to our listener who wanted to know if anything has changed at the State Department? That was Donald's question.
No.
No.
Nothing. So I did not see any change at all in our policies in Iraq, our work in Iraq, anything to do with Iraq in the change of administrations. And I say that as a remorseful Democratic voter. The policies of the United States in the Middle East have not changed. The reason our troops are leaving Iraq at the end of this year is because Baghdad said no. The previous administration actually negotiated the departure of American troops on December 31st of this year, and President Obama did everything he possibly could to see if he could extend those troops. When the Iraqis finally said no over the issues of immunity, which are traced ironically back to the State Department's mishandling of the Blackwater massacre at Nisr Square in 2007, then we just simply changed landlords. As you had mentioned earlier, Rose, the United States has built the world's largest embassy in Baghdad. We have it staffed by a couple of thousand State Department personnel and contractors. We've hired 5,000 mercenaries to protect those diplomats. We've equipped them with their own helicopters, their own machine guns, their own drones, their own radar, their own armored vehicles. In many ways, we have not finished this occupation. We've simply changed the name of the landlord. And the things that have been done and the issues that Sinan raised earlier, I think, will continue. I don't see any change in policy whatsoever.
Sinan?
You know, for once, the Iraqi puppet government did something right, because they didn't extend, as you said, so that soldiers who rape girls are held accountable under Iraqi law and don't get nothing, just as no one got anything serious for Abu Ghraib or anything else. So for once, the Iraqi regime, because of pressure from the local population, said no. And, you know, this is all in history. Go back to the early 20th century. Almost all of this happened with the Brits with the same way. And human beings do not like to have foreign militaries on their soil. But I should say that a government that steals from its own working class people and channels money to the corporations, as is happening now, and a government that's really insensitive to its own citizens, why would you expect that government to care about Iraqis or want to rebuild Iraq when it didn't even rebuild places in the U.S. that were destroyed by natural disasters? So this is what we have to think of. In a better world, in a slightly better world, Rumsfeld and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice would be in The Hague standing trial. But unfortunately, this is not an ideal world. But in any other society, you know, in America, we congratulate ourselves way too often. In any other society, there would be a more critical discourse about what these people did. Forget about the Iraqis, but what they did in terms of violating the law. That's what we really should be thinking about. And what's really dangerous, frankly, is that, again, nothing is learned from all of this. Now we see the discourse about Iran, and the same tactics have been deployed in terms of, oh, we're worried about Iran, just as the New York Times and others parroted senseless words about Iran being the danger, so that the appetite for war is not gone. And this is, it's amazing. And your boss at the State Department, Hillary Clinton, I mean, she cheered with glee when Gaddafi and his son were killed. And no journalist has asked her, that son who was killed in cold blood is someone you met a year and a half ago in Washington and shook hands with and appeared smiling before the media. No one ever asked her, how does it feel to have someone you met with as a diplomat a year and a half ago be killed in cold blood? But this
it's ironic.
This is the time when, again, an American citizen, the son of Al-Awlaqi, and Al-Awlaqi, the terrorist in Yemen, is killed in violation of all kinds of international law, and the media cheers.
And Peter, you wanted to jump in? We have about 30 seconds.
It's very ironic that perhaps the only State Department official who's going to lose his job over the issues in Iraq and over the reconstruction is me.
Well, why didn't you resign when you realized that you were sending you to a place where you knew nothing about the culture of the country?
This is my job, and by resigning, I felt that I would step away from the chance to contribute something, to do something useful. In the end of the day, I wrote this book so that people understand what happened in Iraq, and hopefully some Americans will understand that even though we meant well, we didn't do well.
No, we did not mean well. I'm sorry. That's the problem. Because even after going there and writing the book, and I'm sorry to sound like that, you still think that we mean well. There is still a problem of understanding. This is not about intentions.
It's about not repeating the mistakes.
No, but it's about a world that operates through institutions and armies and structures, not individuals.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, and I want to thank both of our guests, Sinan Antoun, Iraqi poet and novelist, co-founder of Jadalia, assistant professor of New York University, and Peter Van Buren, author of We Meant Well, longtime State Department Foreign Service officer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, and thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Who was Robin Hood, and why is his story still relevant today? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Paul Buell and Sharon Rudall, author and illustrator of the new graphic novel Robin Hood, People's Outlaw and Forest Hero. Buell writes, whether Robin Hood and his companions existed or not does not matter. They existed and exist in the hearts of rebels everywhere. So what has Robin Hood's story meant over time, and what is it about him that captures our imaginations? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor, and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.